Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Taiwan. With me to discuss how the Biden administration should approach policy toward Taiwan is Ambassador Robert Blackwell. Bob is the Henry A. Kissinger Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council and a member of the Harvard Kennedy School's Applied History Project. He previously served as Deputy Assistant to the President, Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Planning, and Presidential Envoy to Iraq under President George W. Bush. From 2001 to 2003, Bob was Ambassador to India. His most recent book is War by Other Means, Geoeconomics and Statecraft, co-authored with Jennifer M. Harris. Bob is also the co-author with Philip Zelikow of the Council Special Report, The United States, China, and Taiwan, A Strategy to Prevent War, which was released this past February. You can download the full report at CFR.org. Bob, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks very much for having me, Jim.
Bob, I have to say, A Strategy to Prevent War is an ominous subtitle. And I'll also note that at the beginning of your report with Phil Zelikow, you write that Taiwan is becoming the most dangerous flashpoint in the world for a possible war that involves the United States of America, China, and possibly other major powers. Now, I want to get in the course of our conversation to why you have come to this conclusion. But if we may, can we begin with a bit of history? Can you lay out for us why Taiwan has this unusual status in which it doesn't have diplomatic relations with the United States, and the United States doesn't even regard it as a country, yet the U.S. may still come to its defense?
Well, first of all, let me say that the United States has a very long relationship with Taiwan, some of it rather indirect. Some of our listeners will know that the U.S. during the Second World War made very elaborate plans to invade Taiwan, which was then occupied by the Japanese. In the end, we went around Taiwan because it seemed so formidable to launch an invasion, a Guadalcanal kind of invasion, which has its relationship to the current situation, which we'll get to after 1950, and of course, the end of the Chinese Civil War. Chiang Kai-shek, the loser of that civil war, flees to Taiwan. And the U.S. Had a rather neutral view for a few years, but when the Korean War began and Chinese forces crossed the Yalu River, the U.S. regarded correctly as China as an enemy, and for decades believed that Taiwan should be defended. That was the case all the way through the 1950s and 60s, and it was affected in the early 1970s by Nixon and Kissinger during the opening to China. The most controversial issue was how would the United States treat the issue of the future of China? And it was resolved in a communique, the so-called Shanghai communique, in 1972, where the United States said that it accepted the definition by both regimes, the one on Taiwan and the one on the mainland, that there was one China. Now, of course, the one on Taiwan claimed it was the legitimate government of China. The one in Beijing asserted the same thing.
This was a wonderful diplomatic fudge.
Yeah, it was absolutely brilliant, I might say, in Kissinger finessing the issue. This went on to 1978 when the United States established diplomatic relations with China. China entered the United Nations. And from then till now, the United States has pursued the so-called One China policy, not declaring that either side is the legitimate government of China. And this is, again, finessed over the decades, the issue of the future of Taiwan. What's happened to call that into question, and I will end this bit of history, is growing support in the United States, and especially in the Congress, for Taiwan. Support is stronger in the Congress now than in many decades in Taiwan, and there are members of the Congress who'd like the United States to abandon the One China policy and to endorse Taiwan's independence. After all, it's a country of 24 million, it's a vigorous democracy, and these people argue it's time to put aside One China and recognize Taiwan as the legitimate government of Taiwan. So that pressure is growing. Meanwhile, the other major evolutionary trend has been the people of Taiwan over the decades have become more and more opposed to union with the mainland. China has said from the beginning, all the way through the 60s, 70s, 80s, up until the last 5 or 6 years, that they hope to resolve the issue of unification with Taiwan peacefully, but they would not abandon the possibility of using force to do so. Today, the people of Taiwan are overwhelmingly against union with China, and therefore the question does arise, what will China do about that? Does it believe that there is any longer a peaceful route to unification with Taiwan, or will it conclude the only way to resolve the issue is the use of force?
I want to get into present day, Bob, but I just want to do a little bit more on the history side. So in the late 1970s, President Carter established diplomatic relations with mainland China. He ended diplomatic relations with Taiwan, and he most importantly terminated the mutual defense treaty that the United States had with Taiwan, Bob. Congress responded by passing the Taiwan Relations Act. Rather short bill, I think only about 3 pages, but it is sort of provide the structure for U.S.-Taiwanese relations in the intervening decades. Can you tell us what the Taiwan Relations Act says? Maybe fill us in on a related concept, this notion of strategic ambiguity.
Well, they're related. Let me explain it like this. In the late 1970s, the question arose as the United States broke relations with Taiwan, established relations with China. China entered the United Nations. We ended our defense pact, as you said. Well, what should we, the Americans, think now about our relationship with Taiwan? And we had committed ourselves to going to war on behalf of Taiwan for a couple of decades. Well, what now? This was debated first in the administration. It introduced legislation to the Congress, which the Congress thought was not robust, was not tough enough, did not express our concern about Taiwan in strong enough terms. So then there was a debate within the Congress. What should be the substance of the Congress's view of our relationship with Taiwan? Some at that time, as now, wanted us to just say flatly, we will use force to defend Taiwan if China uses force against Taiwan. This did not elicit a majority. And in the end, the Taiwan Relations Act is vague about what the United States should do if China uses force against Taiwan. That vagueness dominated American policy on the issue all the way through the Trump administration, although during the Trump administration, they pushed the boundaries of that vagueness. But in any case, today there's a debate about whether the time has come for us to end that vagueness, which was has been called strategic ambiguity, and instead say quite flatly what we would do if China invades Taiwan. This was debated during the Trump administration, and they could not, in the end, bring themselves to say publicly that we are ending strategic ambiguity. We will do X, whatever X is, with respect to Taiwan if China invades. There has been a debate in the last several months about this, but I think at least for the Biden administration, the issue has been decided. They've said publicly that there are major problems with respect to strategic clarity, as it's called, saying much more directly what the United States would do. Avril Haines, the director of national intelligence, testified in the Congress that the Chinese would think that such an end to strategic ambiguity would be deeply destabilizing. The administration has said expressly that there are major downsides to ending strategic ambiguity. So it appears that at least in the Biden administration, strategic ambiguity will continue.
Bob, I will note that the Biden administration has a favorite phrase, it seems, when talking about Taiwan. And it seems to be, our commitment to Taiwan is rock solid. But you're telling me that the administration's not willing to go so far as to embrace this idea of strategic clarity, which raises the question of how rock solid is the commitment?
Well, rock solid was a new term. And the people who follow this closely are rabbinical scholars on every word and every comma of what the commitment of the United States is with respect to Taiwan. So people debated, well, does rock solid mean something more than the past? Whether it did or not, and they've repeated that phrase several times, they are not willing to go further and say something more specific about what the United States would do with respect to a Chinese attack on Taiwan.
So what is your assessment of the idea of strategic clarity?
Well, the report that Philip Zelikow and I wrote opposes strategic clarity for two reasons. One is that China regards strategic ambiguity as a central element in one China. So that's the first part. And I believe the Chinese would interpret the end of strategic ambiguity and the establishment of strategic clarity as a violation of one China. The second is the worry that if we were to say explicitly that we were coming with force to the defense of Taiwan, wouldn't that undermine Taiwan's willingness to spend the resources to defend itself? So for both those reasons, we in our report oppose any change in the policy of strategic ambiguity.
And I should just note, for interest in full disclosure, the individual who has pushed the idea of strategic clarity and brought it to the forefront of the debate is our mutual boss, Richard Haass, in a foreign affairs article that he co-authored with our colleague, David Sachs. Before I go down this road a bit more, Bob, I want to sort of take a step back and maybe ask a fundamental question. Certainly a question I think a lot of Americans who don't follow foreign policy or who aren't up in all of the ins and outs of Taiwan policy and aren't parsing rock solid versus strategic ambiguity. And that would be, why is it in the U.S. interest to come to the defense or create the impression that we might come to the defense of Taiwan?
Well, Taiwan is a vigorous democracy of 24 million people. It's a symbol of the ability of nations to leave dictatorship behind and adopt our American values with respect to how societies ought to be organized and function. And therefore, of course, for the United States, for a dictatorship, that is to say, China, to use force to subdue Taiwan would be a major violation of our values. The issue then arises, but what about our national interests? Because vital national interests are often defined as those for which the United States is willing to go to war. For example, it has a treaty with Japan, which was ratified by the U.S. Congress, which commits the United States, in essence, to go to war if Japanese territorial sovereignty is violated by China. So we have that commitment. The question that is now being debated is whether we should have that commitment to Taiwan, that we would come to their aid with American force. And there are many who say we should, and there are more who say leave it ambiguous. Now, if you have a rigorous, and this is all laid out in the report, definition of vital national interests, it is difficult to see how Taiwan would figure as a vital American national interest unless you say every democracy in the world, the U.S. should commit itself to go to war if it's in danger. That would be a grand departure of our policies over our history. And if you don't have that view, what is it special about Taiwan that would justify U.S. going to war? And we lay out five national interests, and Taiwan doesn't directly qualify in any of them. Final point on national interests, the people who argue for a U.S. commitment to use force to defend Taiwan say it's a vital national interest, but they don't usually or almost ever say how they came to that conclusion. And the people who are against it say it isn't a vital national interest. And they, too, never usually say how they came to their conclusion. So what we've tried to do, Philip and I, in our report, is to provide an analytical framework where people can make their own judgment about that crucial question. One final point, Jim, which is the polling shows that the American people, by a substantial margin, do not support the United States going to war with China over Taiwan. Such polls, however, are not definitive. That is to say, Americans can change their mind in a hurry. In 1950, they thought before the Korean War, we shouldn't go to war with Korea. Within a few months, there was an overwhelming majority to fight on the Korean Peninsula. But at least at the moment, the American people do not support America going to war with Taiwan, which may also be a function of the long wars we've been in and the American people are sick of going to war.
Well, Bob, obviously a decision to threaten or carry out a threat to defend a country like Taiwan depends upon one's assessment of how defensible Taiwan is. I've read a number of people who are skeptical of the ability of the United States if not today, in coming years to defend Taiwan. Tanner Greer has written a number of pieces really questioning the capability and status of the Taiwanese military. And so I have to ask you, from your vantage point, is Taiwan a defensible place?
Well, let me begin by saying that one can't be sure, always, until the battle begins. But let me say what one can say, which is, first of all, China has made very substantial advances in changing the balance of forces across the Taiwan Straits in the last 15 years. You might put it like this. The United States has global responsibilities, designed its military for contingencies all around the globe. China has, in the last 15 years, concentrated largely on the issue of trying to gain enough force across the straits to deter the United States from intervening in a Taiwan crisis, and if it did intervene, to defeating American forces across the strait. And they have made major advances in that regard. The conventional wisdom is, and of course, one would have to see the top secret plans of the Pentagon in this regard, but the conventional wisdom is that Taiwan today has weak defenses against the contingencies in which China would use force and was probably not be able itself to withstand a major attack by China. However, the same conventional wisdom says that this is not an impossible task, that if Taiwan were to acquire enough sensors and enough missiles, that it could begin to form such a formidable defense that it would strengthen deterrence with regard to a possible Chinese attack.
That's a so-called porcupine strategy. Make yourself indigestible.
Right, exactly. And the public information available suggests this could be done in 3 to 5 years. There are not many in public who argue that it could be done today. And there's a series of, now in this sphere, very well-known press stories which assert that in the last 17 or so war games that have been played, both in public and in the inner reaches of the U.S. defense establishment, China's won all but one. Obviously, it has an enormous advantage in geography, being close to Taiwan. And Taiwan has tended to buy big-ticket items, submarines and F-16s, whose utility in such a crisis is not obvious, instead of buying, as I say, missiles and sensors, which would have a major effect on the battle space. So the U.S. might well face a situation, if China were to use force, in which Taiwan could not defend itself successfully, and the issue would arise for an American president: do we, whatever our doctrinal position is, strategic ambiguity, do we rush our forces into the battle?
Do you worry, Bob, more about a potential Chinese amphibious invasion, sort of a D-Day in the 21st century? Or are you more concerned about so-called gray area activities where the Chinese more nibble? It's still coercive, but it isn't quite a massive military undertaking.
Before I get to that, let me just say something very positive with respect to the people of Taiwan. Now, for 20 years, China has used every coercive method short of the use of force that it could imagine. And the effect of that on the people of Taiwan, I mentioned earlier, has been to make them more and more opposed to union with the mainland. And they are to be congratulated for their resolve and resiliency in this regard. Now, with respect to scenarios, we go over these in the Council report and in a companion piece we wrote for War on the Rocks. And there are three basic scenarios. One is the all-out invasion, maybe closer to Okinawa than Normandy. So that's the most direct use of force. In that same way, an attack on Taiwan might be a decapitation strategy, special forces, hellebore special forces, parachutists, and so forth, in which they would try to decapitate the Taiwan government. So that's one option. A second is an attack on one of the smaller islands in the Taiwan group. And the third would be, of course, quarantine, a kind of mirror image of the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which China would say, we're not going to interrupt ordinary commerce to and from Taiwan, but if we believe that planes or ships are carrying military hardware or military advisors, then we will divert them to a Chinese airfield or Chinese port where they will be examined. And therefore, we call on all nations to observe this quarantine, and we will do what's necessary to enforce it. Those are the three broad options, and our work then addresses what the U.S. should do about those options.
Before we get to that, Bob, I want to note we've been talking about the United States, Taiwan, and China, but there are a lot of countries in the region who are very interested in what is transpiring, most notably the other members of the Quad, Japan, India, where you served as ambassador, and Australia. How did they view this evolving source of tension? Do we see countries coalescing behind U.S. leadership? Do we see countries edging away? Do we see countries hedging? How are they viewing this, particularly given your observation that recent news out of war games is that China wins far more often than it loses?
The most important country in that regard is Japan. And it's so important that many analysts believe the United States can't fight a war in the Taiwan Straits without using U.S. assets on Japanese territory and so forth. So Japan is the most important by several magnitudes. And they, like our other treaty allies, Australia, South Korea, the Philippines, Thailand, no one wants a war over this issue. The Australians in particular highly admire Taiwan's democracy, but at the same time do not want to have to choose between Taiwan and a war between the United States and China, which could easily draw them in. So they've liked the position of strategic ambiguity. So no journalist can ask them. The Americans have just said specifically what they're going to do if China uses force against Taiwan. Prime Minister of Japan, what is Japan going to do? And that is not a question the Japanese government has been willing to answer over the decades. Whether in a real contingency, and if the American president decided to go to war over Taiwan, his first phone call would be to the Japanese prime minister saying, we want you with us. And at that point, one can say, who knows what that answer will be? The Japanese public has not been prepared to have an opinion on that subject. The Japanese governments have preferred to avoid it, to push it at the side. And so it would be highly controversial inside Japan and less controversial in Australia. And the South Koreans in particular want no part of this problem.
Let's close, Bob, by looking at what you think the United States should do with regard to Taiwan. And I'll note that in the report you did with Phil Zelico, you summarized your suggestions by first, stop spraying gasoline, and second, develop a more credible firefighting strategy. How does that translate into practical government action?
Danger of metaphor. Wordsworth said metaphor kills thought. But in any case, we lay out four options for the U.S. response. First, and there are people who support each of these options in the country. The first is simply declare that Taiwan is not a vital national interest of the United States, that it's in China's sphere of influence, and we will not defend Taiwan. Charles Glaser recently wrote an article on this score, and so that's option one. Option two has been the position of American administrations and appears that it may evolve into the position of the Biden administration. And that is strategic ambiguity. We do not say that we will defend Taiwan, but we prepare to do so in case the president so orders. Now, the problem with that is that since we don't know whether we will or we won't, we cannot discuss it in any detail with our allies, and it's mysterious to them about what we ought to do. So that's the second option. The third is one that the Trump administration came very close close to endorsing, which is we will fight for Taiwan. The national security strategy they leaked at the end of the administration does not say so directly, but heavily implies that their defense policy is based on the thought that we would defend Taiwan with force. And not only that, that we would attack the Chinese mainland early in the conflict, which of course is a very big idea and could lead to attacks on the American homeland, for example. The fourth option is the one that Philip and I advance, which is keeping option two, strategic ambiguity, but preparing to fight and doing everything we can to strengthen Taiwan defenses consistent with the Taiwan Relations Act, but bring a geoeconomic dimension into this, which is making clear that if there's a conflict initiated by the Chinese, cross-states conflict, that the United States would act to essentially rupture China's external economic relations. We would end all economic interaction with China. We can embargo trade to and from China. And the notion here is that we would want the Chinese to know that this is what we intended if they started a war over Taiwan, that we would strengthen deterrence in this way. To try to vivify it, we hope that if Xi Jinping ever does have a meeting in which the issue of whether they should use force against Taiwan was the subject of the meeting, and the PLA says, Mr. President, we can do this. We've studied this and studied it and studied it. We run war game after war game. We can win a cross-straits crisis with the Americans over Taiwan. We want the economic principles of the Chinese government to say that may be so, but we would also have to take into account the effect of the Chinese economy if the United States does what it has said it's going to do and what it's been planning with the Japanese and others it would do to damage our economy. And we have to think in terms of the internal stability of China, in addition to thinking about the pure military issue of cross-straits conflict. So we're trying to strengthen deterrence here because we, like everyone else, don't want a war over Taiwan. And this has gone in the report into much greater detail. But the reason that we wrote this was, since the future is uncertain, nobody can be sure whether Taiwan will come under attack from the Chinese, we need to prepare as if it would. At the moment, Philip and I think we are not sufficiently prepared. We don't think that deterrence is sufficiently strong. We worry that a frustrated Xi Jinping, seeing that there's no course to peaceful unification, especially after the events in Hong Kong, we worry that there could be a spasm on China's part and they could use force. We're not predicting it, but if it were to happen, we need to be ready. The United States, the Japanese, our friends and allies in Asia and Europe to deal with it.
Just one quick closing question, Bob, which is, I think for many people listening to this conversation would say, I understand how threatening economic retaliation against China could enhance deterrence, but they might say to themselves, but since the United States and China are economically interconnected, couldn't China return the favor and deeply wound the American economy as well?
The answer is yes, in principle, that China has its own economic tools. It could sell its U.S. bonds. Of course, if it did, it would take tremendous losses, of course, as it did so. But we don't rule that out. But I would answer those who worry about this, correctly worry about this. Imagine an American president is faced with two choices. One is to risk that by trying to strengthen deterrence, recognizing that it would not be cost-free for the United States to do such an economic embargo against China, or to go to war with China, with everything that entailed with respect to the American economy and the blood and treasure of the United States. My experience in government, Jim, and you've had the same, is when an issue of this importance, of this magnitude, faces an American president, there are always good arguments against doing whatever you wish to do. And an honest administration administration looks as hard at the arguments against as at the arguments for. That hasn't always been done, tragically, in our recent history. And therefore, there will always be downsides to the chosen course. But at least we think that trying to strengthen deterrence through this geoeconomic means, and then discussing it with our allies, trying to persuade them to come along or hear better ideas from them, is better than our current path, which is in the next at least 3 to 5 years, either go to war or watch Taiwan succumb.
Bob, there's so much more here we could talk about. This is a very complex issue, many levels, but I think we're going to have to end our conversation here and close up the President's Inbox for the week. I want to let everybody know that my guest has been Ambassador Bob Blackwell, Henry A. Kissinger Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy here at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can find his Council Special Report, which he co-authored with Philip Zelikow, entitled The United States, China, and Taiwan, A Strategy to Prevent War, on CFR.org. Bob, again, as always, pleasure to chat with you. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.